You are listening to a Bible talk recorded at the 2002 Western Christadelphian Bible School at Manuka. This is the fourth class in a series given by Brother John Halliwell on the subject, The Life of David. This class is titled, David the Sovereign.
We now come, brothers and sisters, to our fourth consideration of the life of David. This one is David as a sovereign. And the biblical subtitle would be something like, God has given me many sons. David's capacity as a sovereign was compromised by his sin. Earthly monarchs have often wielded absolute power and regarded themselves above the law. But this is an option that wasn't open to David. He must live by the law of his God, the God whom he served and loved. As a man after God's own heart, he must reign righteously and justly, as God is righteous and just. And until the episode with Uriah, this is exactly what David had done. His acceptance, for example, of Abigail's advice when he intended to destroy Nabal and his family, and the time when he'd reiterated the law of God regarding dividing the spoil amongst those who went to battle and those who stayed at home. These were examples of David at his best. But now David must reign with a handicap. To what extent the knowledge of his adultery and murder of Uriah was understood by the majority of his subjects, we can only surmise. Nathan had exposed the sin to David's face, but others would know of it behind his back. Joab was privy to the murder of Uriah, and others would have thought it a strange coincidence that Bathsheba had a child when she did, when her husband was away at war, and that David took her into his house immediately afterwards, and his intense concern for this child of Bathsheba that was dying, it was far too altruistic for it to be someone else's child. So we must conclude, I think, that at least in the palace and within the family, David's sin was common knowledge. And the ramifications of that sin we will now trace through David's reign as king. We begin then in 2 Samuel chapter 13, where we realize that good looks run in David's family. Absalom was most handsome. His sister Tamar was very beautiful. And Amnon, David's eldest son, fell in love with his half-sister. Amnon had a friend, Jonadab, who was a very shrewd man, as one translation has it. The very subtle man in the Authorized Version isn't the same word as the subtlety of the serpent in Genesis. But he was a shrewd man. He noticed Amnon's condition and discovered that he was lovesick for Tamar. Now, our modern free association between young people was probably not the norm. Amnon would only have a few and fleeting opportunities to see her and perhaps talk with her. And there may be other factors that led to this situation. David's family was large, and it's almost certain that the girls were raised separately from the boys. So the normal family relationships of brother and sister in the family were not forged. In some senses, Tamar was almost a stranger to Amnon. And it may be then a little more understandable why he might have fallen in love with his half-sister. He had a precedent. Abraham had married his half-sister. This, of course, didn't override God's law, but it might have weighed in Amnon's mind. And the fact that he was the eldest son and would one day, he assumed, assume the throne of David may be, again, something that encouraged him to continue with his suit for his half-sister. Jonadab, shrewd or wise, whichever way you look at it, certainly had no scruples. "You're a king's son," he said. "You can do what you like." And he devised a scheme. The idea was that Amnon would pretend to be sick, and he would lose his appetite, and the only one who could restore it would be his half-sister Tamar. She would come and cook something special for him, and of course this might be allowed. The fact that David had visited him made it clear that the knowledge of his sickness, and maybe a serious sickness, had been advertised throughout the family. And no doubt he was a good actor at playing the part. A sick man posed no threat to his sister, and anyway she was his sister. So David ordered Tamar to do what Amnon had asked. Watching the cooking didn't restore his appetite, and so he commanded the servants to leave and suggested that if Tamar were to come and feed him as herself, he might regain some of his appetite and might be able to eat something. Alone with Tamar and at close proximity, Amnon raped her. She, of course, protested as soon as she realized his intention. She suggested that if he spoke to the king, he might approve of it. But this was unlikely. But, of course, I mean, she was in desperate straits. She had to try to suggest something that might stop this. And then, afterwards, he hated her with the same passion with which he'd lusted for her. It was obvious that he didn't really love her. He just wanted her. She was no longer on a pedestal, but lay solid at his feet. He dismissed her, but she wouldn't go. His raping of her was bad enough, but to dismiss her now as a ruined girl was even worse. If he'd insisted that they ought to get married, that might at least have ensured that she was provided for. But where could she go now? Who would want her? Who would want a solid princess? Her future was ruined. She returned home with her garment rent and ashes on her head, and her brother Absalom realized what had happened. He consoled her with a comment that since Amnon was a relative, it had at least been kept in the family, and she remained in Absalom's house. When David heard what had happened, he was furious. But that was about all he could be. He could do little else. Amnon, under the law, should have been executed for what he'd done. But how could David exact the penalty against his own firstborn son when he himself had committed adultery and then compounded it with the crime of murder? Absalom kept his peace, almost unnaturally saying nothing good or nothing bad to Amnon. And this lasted for 2 years, by which time I'm assuming that everyone thought that there would be no revenge taken. He'd forgotten about it. Everyone had more or less forgotten about it. It was a time of sheep shearing, and the celebrations were being prepared, and Absalom extended an open invitation to all the princes and to the king himself. They were going to have a really good time, this sheep shearing, and celebrate it. David thought that this was really quite too much an imposition upon Absalom and said that he would be a severe burden if he was to attend and the whole family, but Absalom persisted and secured the king's agreement that at least Amnon and the other princes should go. David blessed Absalom, perhaps thinking that his special mention that Amnon should come showed that all was forgiven regarding Tamar. But of course this was all a subterfuge to provide Absalom with an opportunity to kill Amnon. And in the height of the celebrations, when Amnon was relaxed and off guard, his heart merry with wine, Absalom's servants obeyed the command to kill him. This pandemonium broke out. Each of the princes saddled his royal mule and fled from the scene, possibly in all directions. In the chaos, a messenger who had seen what had happened rushed to tell David. And travelling ahead, he brought the news. He assumed that Amnon and all the princes had died. He knew that Amnon was the first to die, but he assumed that Absalom was getting rid of all possible opposition to his taking the throne. The news was devastating. God had warned David through Nathan that the sword would not depart from his house. But he wouldn't imagine for a moment that it would destroy his own household, the whole house in one fell swoop. In fact, there was a paradox here, wasn't there? Had not the Lord promised to build him a house, that is, a dynasty, a household? And it seemed now that the sword had fallen and all his sons were dead. At this point, Jonadab, Amnon's close friend, arrived with more accurate news. I don't like this man. This young man was a know-all, wasn't he? Oh, yes, this was planned years ago. I knew this would happen, was his attitude. It was only to be expected. Absalom had been plotting this since the Tamar incident. Well, why didn't he tell his friend Amnon that he knew this was likely to happen? Well, as the royal princes returned home one by one, Absalom fled to his in-laws. There was considerable sadness all round, but it's interesting that David mourned for Absalom. And the soul of the king longed to go forth unto Absalom, for he was comforted concerning Amnon, seeing he was dead. This seems to be a characteristic of David, doesn't he? He grieved for Bathsheba's child, but once it died, he accepted that this was God's will. Nothing further could be done. So here, nothing further could be done about Amnon. He did deserve punishment, but he didn't deserve to be murdered in cold blood before he'd been properly tried and condemned. Absalom, by his behaviour, was effectively admitting that what he'd done was wrong. The king had failed to exercise his sovereignty once more. Tamar had been despoiled, Amnon had been murdered, Absalom was now exiled. In 2 Samuel 14, we find Joab concerned, deeply concerned, about Absalom's absence. Presumably at this time he was concerned that if David in some way became a weak king, then the kingdom would be weak, and that was not in Joab's interest. If David became ineffective while Absalom was in exile, then he'd have to rely on another son. And it may be even now that Joab guessed that that son would be Solomon, and perhaps he didn't think too highly of Solomon. Later, events were to show that as far as the people were concerned, Absalom was the obvious successor to David. Joab decided if the king wouldn't listen to reason from his closest associates, then perhaps he could be trapped into making the right decision. And so he briefed a wise woman from Tekoa, about 6 miles south of Bethlehem, to play the part of someone who had a case to be heard at the king's court. And she came as an appellant, seeking the king's judgment on a difficult case. She came as a woman in deep mourning, and she related the facts of the case. Firstly, her two sons had quarrelled, and in the ensuing fight, one had killed the other. The family, and particularly the avenger of blood, were demanding that the surviving son should be put to death, in accordance with the law. And she pointed out that if this happened, she would lose both her sons, and as a consequence, because she was a widow and her husband had died, the family line would die out. And of course, as you know, in Israel, this was very important, that the family should be perpetuated. So David recognized that this case was difficult. He presumably determined that the incident was hardly premeditated. They were brothers who quarreled, and it's likely that the death was accidental. There didn't seem to be any weapon used or an ambush, so it was not technically murder under the pattern of the law in Numbers 35. And so David concluded it was manslaughter. And therefore he could assure this widow that no one would be allowed to kill her surviving son. Once more David was to learn, "Thou art the man." For if I may paraphrase what the woman says in 1 Samuel 14:12 onwards, she said, "You have a problem like mine. One of your sons is dead and the other is banished. And if he was to come back, strictly speaking, he must be executed for murder. But God devises means. God devises ways. Just as he'd done in sparing David." Once more, David had been forced to recognize his own failure to demonstrate his sovereignty. But he did recognize that this was the hand of Joab. And he asked the woman, "Is the hand of Joab with you in this?" And of course, the answer was it was true. I've come to the conclusion that Joab had tried to persuade the king, and David would hear nothing of it. David was becoming difficult to talk to. He wasn't the old David that Joab knew. But he could hardly now refuse Joab's plea, because he determined this case, a fictitious case, of course. But the principle had been clear. Absalom could return to court. Sorry, not quite. He could return home, but he must not appear in court. This was a half measure. It was neither one thing or the other. 2 years passed, exactly the time that Absalom waited in order to kill Amnon. But now the time would pass slowly. Absalom sent for Joab. If Joab had achieved something, maybe he would achieve more. Maybe he would get him returned to the court. Joab ignored the summons. Perhaps the king was being difficult. Joab was having now to tread carefully. Absalom sent once more, with the same lack of result. Then he thought of a good way of getting Joab to come and see him. He set fire to his barley crop. And, you know, in his anger, Joab said, you know, what on earth are you doing that for? And so he was able to talk to Joab, and it worked. Joab went to plead with David, and finally the king now agreed. But once more, David was impotent to take the opportunity of rebuking Absalom. He ought to have accepted Absalom only if he came into court after a stern lecture in which Absalom was required to apologize, to submit to the king, and everyone in court would then know that David was in control of his kingdom, and that this kind of behavior would not be tolerated. This would be the last straw, and if Absalom stepped out of line again, that would be it. But how could he, adulterer and murderer as he was, lecture other people? Once he was back in favour, and we're now in 2 Samuel 15, Absalom began to acquire the trappings of the heir apparent. He was the next son. He was now in line for the throne. And he looked the part. And they said that no one was like Absalom for his beauty. He was a handsome man. He had this long flowing hair, apparently, and he only had a haircut, by the looks of it, once a year. And when he did, it's amazing, the hair weighed about 5 pounds. So I imagine every time he had his hair cut, it was a load off his mind, wasn't it? Literally. Well, Absalom had this retinue of 50 men as a personal bodyguard. It was no doubt impressive. Absalom no doubt rode on the royal mule, and these runners went with him, and it was very impressive. But what he really did next was the most serious thing. For in 2 Samuel 15, verse 2 onwards, we find that Absalom used to get up early and stand by the gate. Of course, that's where judgment was given in Israel. That's where the king sat to rule. And it was so that when any man had a suit which had come to the king for judgment, Absalom called to him and said, "Where do you come from? Of what city art thou?" And he said, "Thy servant is one of the tribes of Israel." And Absalom said, when he'd obviously inquired about the case, "See, thy matters are good and right, but there is no man deputed of the king to hear thee." And Absalom said, "Oh, that I were made judge in the land, that every man that hath any suit or cause might come to me, and I would do him justice." And it was so, when any man came nigh to do him obeisance, he put forth his hand and took hold of him and kissed him. And on this manner did Absalom to all Israel that came to the king for judgment. So Absalom stole the hearts of the men of Israel. At first sight, it seems that Absalom was intercepting petitioners before they could present themselves to the king, and saying, in effect, "I'm afraid the king won't hear you. There's no one to hear you. But listening to your case, you've got a wonderful case. And if it was up to me, I'd give judgment in your favour." It may even be, of course, that when two men came, Absalom talked to them individually, and he supported the winner and the loser, as it were. And both of them thought Absalom was a really, really good prince because he understood their case. And so he stole the hearts from David for himself. But if you noticed, Absalom said nobody had been deputed to hear these cases. And I begin to think that that must be true, because it suggests that the king was incapacitated in some way, so ill that he couldn't designate a stand-in to rule for him. And if you'll come with me to Psalm 41, I think we have a clue as to what was happening at this time. In Psalm 41, and just for connection, we'll begin with verse 3. I'm reading from the Revised Version. He's talking about someone who's ill. "The Lord will support him upon the couch of his languishing. Thou makest all his bed in his sickness." And then in verse 5 of Psalm 41, "Mine enemies speak evil against me, saying, when shall he die and his name perish?" Absalom was getting ready to take over the throne. When is he going to die? He's seriously ill. It's only a matter of time. Verse 6, "If he come to see me, he speaketh vanity." No doubt Absalom reassured the king, "Oh, there are no problems, father. Everything's going fine. You just get better." "He gathereth iniquity to himself. When he goeth abroad, he telleth it." To others he said, "Oh, the king doesn't care. The cases are building up. If I were king, things would be different." Verse 7, "All they that hate me whisper together against me. Against me do they devise my hurt." The revolt of Absalom is beginning. People are suggesting, it would be good for Absalom to be king. Let's make preparations so that eventually he can be. Verse 8, an evil disease, they say, cleaveth fast unto him, and now that he lieth, he shall rise up no more. This is a terminal illness, as far as they were concerned. Only a matter of time now, when they would need a new king. And even Ahithophel, verse 9, yea, mine own familiar friend, in whom I trusted, which did eat of my bread, hath lifted up his heel against me. And we know that's Ahithophel because John in his Gospel tells us. So the conspiracy is working. David is critically ill, as far as they're concerned, dying. And they're beginning to get used to the idea that it would be nice to have Absalom as king. So, having laid the foundations, Absalom now attempts to seize power. He begins to build the edifice of his revolt. He sought from David leave to fulfill a vow which he'd made in exile. And David would understand this. No doubt he'd made similar vows in the past, hoping that God would bring him to his kingdom. The 200 invitees to this particular celebration are a smokescreen of respectability. No doubt they were all the men who were on Absalom's side. Ahithophel, David's counsellor, was sent for. And the conspiracy was strong. News of Absalom's bid for the throne was conveyed to David. Arise, let us flee, says David. Now why did the warrior king flee so easily, brethren and sisters? It wouldn't be because of personal fear. David feared nothing except his God. If our early assumptions are right, then he was presumably by now recovering from this serious illness. They thought he was going to die, and it may be the fact that he was recovering that prompted Absalom to say, let's go now and revolt and seize the kingdom. But I think there was a more important reason why David fled Jerusalem at this time, because he was a man after God's own heart and he believed what God said, and Nathan's prophecy had told him that one out of his own household was going to bring calamity upon him, one who was close to him, as the NIV says. And I'd like you now, if you would please, to turn to Psalm 16, because I think this is another psalm that gives an insight to what's happening. David realized there was no point in trying to frustrate God's will. This was from the Lord, and so there were other considerations for this godly man. So Psalm 16, which is, of course, a psalm of David. Preserve me, O God, for in thee do I put my trust. I have said unto the Lord, thou art my Lord, I have no good beyond thee. As for the saints that are in the earth, and the same word in Hebrew is land, as for the saints that are in the land, they are the excellent in whom is all my delight. Their sorrow shall be multiplied that exchange the Lord for another God, says the Revised Version. But if you've got an AV, and maybe an RV as well, you realize that many of these words are in italics. What it really says is, their sorrows, I'm reading from the AV now, their sorrows shall be multiplied that hasten after another. There's no word for God there. Their sorrows shall be multiplied that hasten after another. But he won't name him. The other is Absalom. They're hastening after another king. Their sorrows shall be multiplied that hasten after another king. Their drink offerings of blood will I not offer, nor take up their names unto my lips. He won't name them, but it's Absalom, surely. And what David is saying is, I'm not going to make Jerusalem a bloodbath. I won't offer their blood here. Their drink offerings of blood I'll not offer. Now, of course, if you substitute the word Lord in the text, for which there is no word, then it does sound as though it's about a choice between serving God or other gods. But there's no word there, and it could well mean that what David is saying is that their sorrow will be multiplied that hasten after another, Absalom, whom he won't name. So David leaves Jerusalem. Now, it's a fascinating study if you have the time to do it. The parallels between David's flight from Jerusalem and the Lord's leaving the city and crossing the brook Kidron and going to Gethsemane and finally returning have wonderful parallels. If you can get a copy of E.C. Selwyn's book, Oracles in the New Testament, you'll see how he compares the Greek of the Gospel records with the Greek Septuagint Old Testament. He makes the point that he believes that this was the version used by the apostles and possibly even by the Lord himself, and he finds about 26 parallels, many of them just the very same words in the Greek Old Testament and the Greek New Testament. Some perhaps less convincing than the others, but even if you discount those, it's very impressive. Indeed, he actually quotes Stanley, you know, the history of the Jewish church. He says, there's no single day in the Jewish history of which so elaborate account remains as that which describes this memorable flight. There is none that combines so many of David's characteristics. And it really is a worthwhile study to show how David's experiences now, as he leaves Jerusalem during Absalom's rebellion, are paralleled by the Lord's experiences on the night in which he was betrayed. Well, as David leaves, various people come to him. In chapter 15, verse 19, Ittai the Gittite appears in order to join the fleeing party. David was touched by this, but he was moved to suggest that as a stranger, he shouldn't risk joining them, but go home instead, along with his brethren. And his response in 2 Samuel 15:21 is wonderful, isn't it, brethren and sisters? As the Lord liveth, and as my Lord the King liveth, surely in what place my Lord the King shall be, whether for death or for life, even there also will thy servant be. Lord, I'm ready to go with thee both to prison and to death, said Peter. This is another parallel. Here was a man who pledged his loyalty to David, whether it was in life or in death, he would serve his king. Brothers and sisters, we've made a similar pledge, haven't we? We too, in life or death, must serve the king. As David crossed the brook Kidron, a group behind him were carrying the ark. Zadok and Abiathar, with the Levites, suggested that if David had to leave Jerusalem, then he must have the ark of God with him. God's presence must be with him. David realized, of course, that he could have God's presence without the ark. And so in verse 25 he says, the king said to Zadok, carry back the ark of God into the city. If I shall find favor in the eyes of the Lord, he will bring me again and show me both it and his habitation. David realized it was more valuable for Zadok and Abiathar to act as David's eyes and ears in the city and convey intelligence via their respective sons to David. And then another tragedy fell. In verse 31, news that Ahithophel had defected was another blow to David. But he prayed that the counsel of Ahithophel would be turned to foolishness. Now, this prayer was answered, but not quite in the way David wanted. The Lord didn't cause Ahithophel to give foolish counsel, but rather he caused his wise counsel to be rejected in favor of the proposals made by Hushai. And this was, of course, the way in which David was saved. As David reached the top of the ascent of the Mount of Olives, Hushai the Archite appeared, his garment rent and earth on his head as a sign of mourning that David had to leave. Although he wished to join David in exile, David said there was a far more vital role for him. Go back to the city, feign allegiance to Absalom, and attempt to defeat the counsel of Ahithophel. And in this way, he would be able perhaps to help David more directly. There isn't really time to deal with the details of what we're told in chapter 16, how Ziba, the servant of Mephibosheth, appeared, defecting, as it were, from the house of Saul, but bringing asses laden with bread and so on for David's benefit, in order to nourish David and his men, because they'd no doubt left without supplies. As a reward, of course, David gave to Mephibosheth, to Ziba, Mephibosheth's wealth. He decided that Mephibosheth had been disloyal in spite of the fact that David cared for him, and so he summarily gave all his estate to Ziba. And then another visitor arrived when he came to Bahurim. Another of Saul's family, Shimei, the son of Gera, came, cursing David, throwing stones at him and pelting him with earth. He's regarded David as a traitor and responsible for Saul's death. I'm not quite sure how he came to that conclusion. But Abishai said, don't worry, I'll quieten him. Once I've taken off his head, he won't curse you anymore. No, said David. If my own flesh and blood is seeking my life, this man can curse as much as he likes. You know, there's a wonderful character to David, isn't there? This is God's will. I have sinned in the past. If this man wants to curse me, let it so be. But he said he hoped that one day the Lord would reverse these curses and bring blessing to David. Well, by now we find the scene goes back in verse 16 to the throne room in Absalom and with Absalom in Jerusalem, and Hushai the Archite returns and as David had commanded him, and Absalom's suspicious. Why didn't you go with David? He asks. The reply is economical with the truth again, but he wasn't lying, was he? He said he would serve whom the Lord and the people had chosen as king. That was really David. This was no lie. And he met the question with another question. Why should I not serve you? And Absalom, of course, had no answer for this. This is often a Jewish trait, isn't it? You know, ask a question, and the reply is another question. Sometimes it's very effective, and here it was. Absalom was presumably very delighted. He now had both of the wise counselors of Israel, who had been left behind in Jerusalem to maintain the palace, and this was a political expedient. Erect a tent on the palace roof, go into them, and make it clear that you're now king in Israel. And secondly, he should allow Ahithophel to take 12,000 men to pursue David without delay, to overtake him, and while his men were exhausted to kill David, allow his immediate supporters to escape, so eventually they'd come back to Absalom, and within a matter of a day or so, the whole matter would be over. All Israel, David's men, would then accept Absalom as king. This was excellent advice from a man whose reputation was impeccable. But Absalom was curious to know whether Hushai agreed. You know, two heads are better than one. Well, Hushai was very tactful. He explained that normally he would accept Ahithophel's advice. It was usually first rate, but just on this occasion, humanly speaking, it was flawed. It was a stroke of genius, wasn't it? It played on the idea that nobody, not even Ahithophel, was totally infallible. And even better, that he, Hushai, was concerned that the king should have the best possible counsel. So immediately, Absalom is going to listen seriously to what Hushai has to say. And then he set out the flaws, first of all, in Ahithophel's advice. Things that Ahithophel apparently hadn't considered. Firstly, David, Joab, Abishai, and the rest of David's men were experienced, fearless warriors. Secondly, they were now embittered in exile. They had nothing to lose. They would be ruthless and merciless in their opposition. Thirdly, David and his immediate staff would not be with the majority, but probably in hiding. And as in Saul's day, difficult to find. Then, fourthly, when some of Absalom's men were ambushed, David's troops would cause panic amongst the rest, because they'd suddenly remember, yes, David was like this in the past, almost invincible, and so they would defect. Absalom needed a different strategy to defeat David, so he counseled, first of all Israel and raise a massive army that couldn't be defeated. Well, of course, this would give David plenty of time. Then he said, lead the troops yourself. Now, that was a good idea because it would pander to Absalom's pride and prevent Ahithophel from gaining the glory of the victory. Then he said, when David is finally located, it will be possible with such a large force to annihilate the whole of David's following. And so you'll solve the problems immediately. You'll get rid of all David's supporters in one fell swoop. And even if David was to seek refuge in a city and not surrender, there's no problem. With such a force, we'll just dismantle it stone by stone. David cannot win. Absalom and the court decided that that advice was far superior to the counsel offered by Ahithophel. Unbeknown to them, of course, it was the Lord's hand that was swaying their decision. Ahithophel left, returned home, set his house in order, and committed suicide. This extreme response might, at first sight, seem to be a result of the first time in his life ever having his advice rejected. You know, that might be the first reaction, but I don't think that's the answer. I think it was Ahithophel's wisdom that guided him here. I think he realized that Hushai's advice would mean that David would win and that Absalom would be defeated. He could see that that advice was bad advice as far as Absalom was concerned, but good advice for David. So he was faced with a dreadful problem. How could this familiar friend of David, the one with whom he took sweet counsel, face David? He couldn't look David in the face again, could he? He would be disgraced, and David might execute him for treason as an example. Far better to take his own life. Well, in our reading this morning, of course, we moved on to the next episode, which is the death of Absalom, and I'm not going to spend too much time looking at that in great detail. But there are some interesting things that we need to consider with regard to David as a sovereign. With a battle now clearly in prospect, David gave orders for his men to be divided into three groups. It was that David was his old self again now, a strategist. And so Joab and Abishai and Ittai the Gittite would be the leaders. They would split up. This would make it more difficult for Absalom to fight them. And when any one of them was in difficulty, the others, of course, would come to help. David was going to take the lead, but the people wouldn't hear of it. He was the target of the rebels, and he shouldn't risk his life in the battlefield. Rather, he should remain at base. So David consigned his troops to the battle, and his last phrase was particularly poignant, wasn't it? Deal gently with Absalom for my sake. Absalom was guilty of murder, disloyalty, and now treason. Yet to David, he was still a favourite son. Once more, David failed, I'm afraid, to be a sovereign. Such paternal affection is quite understandable, but sadly, it's not a luxury that a king can indulge. Treason is not tolerable, even in a royal prince. In fact, we could go farther to say, particularly in a royal prince. And David really, in a sense, failed to exert his sovereignty. Well, the battle was engaged in woodland. Of course, Joab and the others had long experience of guerrilla warfare in rough terrain. This was perfect for them. Absalom was probably no warrior. His retinue of 50 men might look good, but I suspect he was brought up under much softer circumstances and was probably quite inexperienced in war. And the forest took, of course, a greater toll of men than the actual conflict. And in the confusion, it seems Absalom was somehow separated from these immediate guards, from his bodyguard. And riding along in his mule, of course, he was caught in the branch of the tree. Now, the popular view is that with this mass of hair, somehow that got entangled in the branch. I'm not keen on that one. I suspect he would have some kind of helmet, some head covering. What seems to me more likely is as he rode along, a low branch had a fork in it, and as he went forward, it somehow caught him in the neck. And so he was lifted off his mule, which continued to travel forward, and he was suspended there. And I suspect it was the shock that winded him, possibly rendering for a few moments unconscious. And so he's hanging there when one of David's men discovered him. He went and reported it to Joab, and of course he retorted that he should have fixed him once and for all, dispatched him there and then, and he would have been rewarded richly. But the man, of course, knew Joab. He knew that if he had done that, Joab would disown him. And so Joab wouldn't waste words with this man, and off he went to dispatch Absalom. And he did it with the darts, and then the henchmen around Joab finished him off just to make sure there was no possibility that there was life left in him. The sad thing was there was no state funeral for this traitor, was there? He was tipped into a pit in the forest and stones were piled upon him. Nathan's prophecy had claimed yet another victim. In due course, the watchman saw the messenger arriving, and David thought that this was a case of good news. A single runner must mean that the battle had been successful. A number of stragglers coming home would mean that they had lost. David must have been slightly elated, but still anxious. Finally, the dreaded news comes. Absalom is dead. David couldn't accept this. He was heartbroken and climbed up the stairs into the room above the gate. The returning victors crept silently into the city like men in defeat. There was no victory parade, no march past before their approving king. For Joab, this was the last straw, and he went to see David and reminded him that he was not the only one to grieve. Fathers and mothers had lost their sons in battle, wives were now widows, children were now fatherless as a result, and all he could do was feel sorry for himself. It was as though he would only be satisfied if all his faithful supporters were dead and Absalom was alive. This brought David to his senses. The forthright rebuke had its effect, and David agreed to receive the army, and they returned in the appropriate manner. Then, of course, people realized that as David had won, they had to decide how they were going to make their peace with David. I'm not going to spend time looking at Shimei, who was pardoned, of course, and Ziba and Mephibosheth, who had the situation returned to the way it was before David left. But I would like to just spend a few seconds thinking about Barzillai. That lovely man, that 80-year-old succorer of David at Mahanaim, the two camps. It's a really touching incident, isn't it? It was now David's turn to repay his kindness by inviting to join him at the palace. "Oh, I'm too old for court life," he said. "I can't taste anything anymore, so I wouldn't enjoy the rich food and the wines. I'm deaf now, I couldn't hear the court entertainment. You see, David, I'd only be a burden to you." That's something that always distresses elderly folks, isn't it? They don't want to be a burden. "David, I'd be a burden to you." Being a burden to their loved ones, well, he didn't want that, did he? "I tell you what, I'll just go a little way with you, and then I'd prefer back to go home, a place I'm familiar with, and end my days in familiar surroundings." I'd imagine that David would persist for a while, trying to convince this lovely old man to come and allow David to show him kindness, but he provided the solution instead. He said, "Perhaps you'd like to take my son Chimham, or Kimham, with you instead." What a lovely man he was. Realised David wanted to do something. He didn't want it himself, but he said, "Take my son and, you know, you show him the favours you would have shown me." David was delighted to comply, wasn't he? Assuring that he would do whatever Barzillai asked him. And you know, it's interesting, later, when he came to the end of his life, David charged Solomon with the responsibility of showing kindness to Barzillai's sons and inviting them in successive generations to eat at the king's table. This is David back to his old self, isn't it? Just as an aside, you know, Kimham is mentioned in Jeremiah, where he set up a habitation or a lodging place located at Bethlehem. And the dearly beloved late Brother Harry Whittaker suggests that this might have been the inn where there was no room for David's greater son to be born. I won't deal with the childish behaviour of Israel, squabbling amongst themselves like children as to whose right it was to have David, and we've got, you know, 10 shares in David and you've only got... The whole thing is so childish, isn't it? But I would like to just close with a summary now of what we've seen about David's sovereignty. We've seen in this section, in part, there's much more, but we've seen how David dealt with the problems which arose from Nathan's prophecy regarding his own sin. Time and again, David was compromised by his own former conduct. Amnon's lust for Tamar, Absalom's murder of Amnon, Absalom's rebellion and subsequent death could not be dealt with as they ought to have been because of David. And it may even be that David's behaviour created a climate in the palace in which these sons of David considered that they too could behave as they pleased. It was almost as though the conditions that obtained before the appointment of a king had returned. And at least in David's family, every man was doing that which was right in his eyes.